Hi, I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor for The World. I'm not as familiar a voice as Marco or Carolyn, but I'm no stranger to The World. I was part of the early team that launched the program back in 1996. And if you're a longtime listener of The World, you would have heard me reporting from South Asia during the earlier years of the show. It's great to be back leading such a committed team. And it's an honor to share this work and these stories with you, our listeners. We are able to produce the best in international reporting with the highest production value because of listeners like you who stepped up to support The World financially. Right now, it's a critical time for our nonprofit newsroom, as the funds from this drive help power our reporting year-round. We are coming to the end of our drive, and our goal is to raise $67,000 before December 31st. Can we count on you to meet that goal? Please visit theworld.org/give to donate today and have your donation matched. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you from the whole team here at The World.
Christians around the globe are celebrating a central holiday today, so we're taking the day to look at how people of many different religions make faith a central part of their lives. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Jerusalem, an enclave of Armenian Christians,
the Armenian presence in Jerusalem dates back to the 4th century,
now faces uncertain future due to a legal dispute.
After a year when politics was inescapable, we learn how a temple in India became a flashpoint in elections there.
Plus, spirituality and how it influences worldviews.
Everyone's just grappling for the meaning of life, really. They're looking for it in different ways.
And in Thailand, people leave an offering to the gods in the form of soft drinks.
I've given Fanta to the neighborhood spirits, so they should be satisfied for now.
Religion, spirituality, and some politics. That is all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us.
Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah. Today we are devoting the show to religion and spirituality, revisiting stories that look at how faith influences news events around the globe. And we begin in Jerusalem.
Armenian Christians in the Old City say their future there is under threat. They're a small minority in the area, but have had a visible presence for centuries. Now, Armenian Christians are worried that a real estate deal could uproot them from a place that's central to their identity. The World's Matthew Bell reported this story last spring in Jerusalem.
Entering the Cathedral of St. James is like walking into the Middle Ages. These seminary students from Armenia, young men in long black robes, are part of a Christian tradition that goes back to the Crusades. Most of the cathedral dates from the 12th century, but parts of it are much older. Armenia, about 800 miles away from Jerusalem, was the very first nation to convert to Christianity. St. James Cathedral is the religious center of the Armenian quarter in Jerusalem's Old City. Across the street from the church is a parking lot, but like many locations in this part of the world, it's much more than just a parking lot.
This entire area is called the Historical Armenian Garden.
Hagop Jarnazian is a community activist who grew up here in Jerusalem. He points to the ancient walls of the old city, the seminary, several residential homes, including the home of the Armenian patriarch, who's the head of the Armenian Apostolic Church.
The Armenian presence in Jerusalem dates back to the 4th century. And this plot of land that we are standing in is under the ownership of the Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem for more than 700 years.
And this is the heart of the controversy. The patriarch signed a deal to sell a big piece of this area to a Jewish businessman. That deal was done in secret in 2021. When the details became public last year, people were not happy about it.
So the community pressured on the patriarchate to cancel the deal, and we succeeded.
Late last year, the patriarch tried to get out of the real estate deal. He said he was misled and blamed his own real estate advisor, an Armenian priest himself, who's since been defrocked and fled to the U.S. the patriarch said the agreement to sell the parking lot and surrounding area should be nullified. But the buyers refused to back down. Soon after the patriarch denounced the real estate deal, a group of Jewish men with guns and dogs showed up in the parking lot to confront local Armenians. They had come out to stop a bulldozer used to dig up some of the parking lot and knock down a stone wall. That was about a year ago. Since then, the situation has remained in a stalemate of sorts. There's an ongoing legal battle in Israeli courts. And in the meantime, Hagop Jarnazian, along with a group of Armenian activists, is staying here in shifts to protect the area from demolition.
Members of the community are staying here 24/7. For example, today is my seventh day staying here, sleeping here in the car outside, just to protect the land from illegal constructions of the company and provocations from the company.
This particular property that's at stake right now is fundamental to the ability of Armenian Christians to live as Armenian Christians in the old city of Jerusalem.
Karnig Kirkonian is an American attorney and part of the legal team representing Jerusalem's Armenian community in Israeli court. One part of their argument in this case, which they hope will terminate that 2021 real estate deal, is based on a centuries-old document from the days when the Ottoman Empire controlled this holy city.
What we have is a trust that was created in the late 1500s by an Armenian priest, which essentially bequeathed this property to his issue, his descendants, and if there are no other descendants, then to the Armenian community.
Kirkonian says this shows that the Armenian patriarch didn't have the authority to be selling off land, and he points out that Ottoman-era documents have been used successfully in Israeli courts before. Usually this involves Jewish Israelis claiming ownership over property inhabited by Palestinians. Beyond the legal strategy, though, Kirkonian says this dispute is about maintaining the unique religious diversity in one of the holiest places on earth.
I mean, this is what Jerusalem stands for, particularly given the fact that we, our tax dollars, invest so much money into the region to try to preserve some sort of peaceful coexistence in a region that is, quite frankly, inflamed right now.
The company trying to buy the land in the heart of the Armenian quarter is called Zana Gardens. Kirkonian says it was founded in 2021, right after the now-disputed real estate deal was signed. A lawyer for Zana Gardens told me his client would not allow him to speak with me for this story. The company is allegedly connected to far-right Jewish activists who've been trying to help Israeli Jews buy properties in East Jerusalem. That's where most of the city's Muslims and Christians live. R.E.A. King has been active with this kind of effort. He's also the deputy mayor of Jerusalem. He told me that Zana Gardens asked him to get involved in the legal case, but he says he refused.
I say no, because I'm not sure about the legit of the deal, and my name is important for me. So I prefer not to be involved.
King says this dispute needs to be settled by the courts, not by politicians and not the municipal government. And in any case, as he sees it, the fears expressed by Armenians about being driven out of Jerusalem are overblown. But this is a population that's small and getting smaller. A census from 2006 found fewer than 1,000 Armenians living in the Armenian quarter. Jerusalem City Council member Laura Wharton told me she's suspicious of this real estate deal and that she worries it's all part of the Israeli far right's goal to push non-Jews out of Jerusalem. But she also says she's confident that the Armenians will win their court case and be able to hold on to that highly valued piece of property in the old city.
There is an Israeli law about protecting the holy places, and it explicitly says that Israel is and will be responsible for protecting the holy sites of all religions and protecting freedom of religion and the dignity and rights of the different peoples and the different religions. And I think most Israelis are, an overwhelming majority are supportive of that.
Back in the parking lot, Armenian activists say they're not going anywhere until their legal battle is settled. Using some of the rubble created by that bulldozer, They built a barrier across part of the lot, along with a makeshift shelter to sleep in at night and welcome visitors during the day. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Jerusalem.
Faith and politics often mix, and not always with good results. Last winter, when a new Hindu temple opened its doors in northern India, it was seen as a win for Hindu nationalism. Sushmita Pathak visited Ayodhya at the time to hear how Hindus and Muslims were reacting to the new temple.
Hindu hymns are interspersed with the constant thud of construction in Ayodhya these days. Workers in orange helmets put final touches to a new boulevard. It leads to a grand pink sandstone structure surrounded by huge construction cranes, barely visible through the winter fog. Even a glimpse of it leaves pilgrims overjoyed.
Feeling is like a miracle. It's a very pure feeling that we can't express by words. That's like, you can only feel that, pure devotion.
Teenager Kritika Chaudhary and her family traveled over 350 miles to see the temple. It's dedicated to Ram, one of the main deities in Hinduism. Millions of Hindus consider this a holy place, says her father.
We are so excited. We believe in Ram. My name is Ram Kumar. And to pay regards, respect to Lord Ram, that's why we are here.
Ayodhya is where Hindus believe Ram was born thousands of years ago as the son of an emperor. According to Hindu texts, he is the ideal man. He obeys his stepmother when she banishes him from the kingdom. And when his wife is kidnapped by a demon king, the warrior prince fights valiantly to save her. Ram's triumphant return to Ayodhya is celebrated by Hindus as Diwali, the festival of lights. The mood in Ayodhya these days is equally festive, if not more. Because Lord Ram is returning to Ayodhya once again, says local shopkeeper Suchi Kumar.
We've been waiting for this moment for 500 years, he says.
Hindus like him believe there was an ancient Ram temple in Ayodhya, at his exact birthplace. But in the 16th century, they say the Muslim emperor Babur displaced their beloved deity by destroying it and built a mosque instead. Despite little evidence to prove that the Babri mosque was built on temple ruins, it became an epicenter of Hindu-Muslim tensions, which exploded on 6 December 1992. A frenzied mob of Hindus who'd come from all over the country attacked the mosque. They flattened its three domes with pickaxes and metal rods. Riots broke out, killing hundreds across South Asia, one of the bloodiest bouts of violence in Indian history, all over a small patch of land. Just down the street from the temple, I meet Muhammad Shahid. His grandfather was the last imam of the Babri mosque. As the mosque fell and riots erupted, Shahid, 22 at the time, took refuge in a police station. The rioters killed my father and uncle, he says. They attacked other Muslim shrines and tore off pages of the Quran. Dozens of Muslim homes were set on fire, including that of Azim Qadri, who was 8 at the time. Sensing the turmoil, Qadri's father had sent him off to relatives in the next town. When he returned, it felt like his neighborhood had been hit by an earthquake, he says. Our mosque was snatched from us, but we have accepted our fate. Ayodhya's Muslims want peace now, he says. Some Muslim families in Ayodhya are leaving town out of caution as Hindus across India flock to the temple. Hotel prices in and around the small town have skyrocketed. Ravi Karkala is part of the temple's trust.
There's a lot of craze among people because this is a big, big civilizational movement.
It's also a big moment for Modi's party, the BJP, which led a grassroots movement in the 1980s and 90s to build a Ram temple in Ayodhya. On that fateful day in December 1992, just before crowds charged at the mosque, BJP leaders were giving fiery speeches. Sanjay Kumar is with the Center for the Study of Developing Societies in New Delhi.
BJP's commitment for Ram temple, BJP's commitment for the cause of Hindus has been unchallenged, and there has been no, you know, wavering in terms of BJP's stand on that.
Now the BJP has delivered on its promise. A few decades ago, building a temple in place of the mosque was unthinkable, says Kumar. To diffuse tensions, many Indians wanted a hospital to be built on the disputed site. That has changed now. There's a sense of euphoria about the temple, and the fringe ideology of Hindu nationalism or Hindutva is front and center.
Hindutva politics is the mainstream politics. Hindutva is the way to move ahead. All political parties are trying to toe that line.
Modi's critics say it is a decisive moment in the creation of a Hindu first nation. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Ayodhya, Northern India.
Hi, I'm Tinku Ray, Executive Editor for The World. I don't often have the opportunity to step behind a mic these days, so I want to take this chance to extend a few heartfelt thank yous and ask for help. First, a sincere thank you to all of our listeners. You are the thread that runs through our reporting. It's always an honor to share this work and these stories with you. We hope that after listening to our program, you have a better, more empathetic, and nuanced understanding of the world and our global community. To our team, thank you. I'm proud of your work and grateful for your integrity, passion, and of course, the excellent journalism you produce. And finally, our listener members who generously support our programming, thanks for being with The World. As a nonprofit newsroom, we rely on your support to keep doing this vital work. Right now, we could really use your help. We are quickly approaching the end of the year, and time is running out to reach our goal of $67,000 by December 31st. If you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. A generous donor has offered to match every donation dollar for dollar, doubling your impact. If you've donated in the past, consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small increment. This drive is critically important in sustaining our reporting year-round, and every gift gets us closer to our goal. I know we can count on you. Please visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you from all of us at The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Politics and religion are the two things we get told not to bring up at a dinner party. We are diving into both with our next story. Every country has traditions and tropes in election campaigns. In the U.S., kissing babies and eating fried food at the state fair come to mind.
In Taiwan, visiting Taoist temples is all part of the campaign. It gives politicians a chance to show their spiritual side in public while trying to win over the voters' hearts, minds, and souls. The World's Patrick Nguyen reported this story during election season in Taiwan last December.
The temple air is hazy with incense. Dozens of worshippers clad in tangerine-colored robes are praising the gods. I'm spending part of the day with Zeng Poyu, a candidate for the legislature, and we're now at Taiping Temple. She's in jeans and running shoes, dressed like someone on the go. Zeng stands before a massive brass urn. Her head is bowed, her eyes shut, and her lips are moving. Zeng is praying, but it's hard to make out what she's saying over the horns and the clang of cymbals. What did you pray for?
I just pray for, I wish I could get elected so I could do service for these people and speak for these people.
Zeng is running for Taiwan's legislature for a district in New Taipei City. She's with the Democratic Progressive Party, currently running the government. Following Taoist tradition, every time she visits a temple, like this one, she introduces herself, saying to the spirit world, "It's me, Zeng Poyu, 31 years old, and here's my address."
You've been introducing yourself to many gods lately on this campaign.
No, you have to do this because so many people make a wish. So you have to say who you are, where do you live, in order for them not to make a mistake when they are showing the miracle, showing like their power.
There are hundreds of gods and goddesses in Taoism, and they can make mistakes. They're not all omnipotent. Taoists in Taiwan believe in spiritual forces underlying the universe. Deities represent different forces, like love or benevolence. Some are like patron saints, favored by specific groups, fishermen, police, or couples trying to get pregnant. Zeng often prays to a deity portrayed as blazing across the heavens on wheels of fire. His name is Taizi. He is the patron of truck drivers, taxi drivers, and those on long journeys, like running for office. But Zeng didn't always take prayer seriously. As a kid, her parents didn't raise her all that religious.
They go to temples, whatever gods they saw, they just bye-bye. It's kind of a tradition instead of a real religion.
To bye-bye is to pay respect to spirits or ancestors. Taiwan's population is roughly one-third Taoist, one-third Buddhist, with most of the rest, when polled, saying they follow no religion. But Taiwanese people don't fit into neat boxes. Many blend Buddhist and Taoist beliefs. Others might say they're atheist, but go to the temple and bye-bye if they're stressed. The pressure of campaigning is what drove Zeng Poyu to start praying in earnest. But that's not the only reason she goes to temples. In Taiwan, according to the government, there's a religious building roughly every square kilometer. Temples are like community centers where people hang out.
And when you go talk to them, when you go make friends with these people, they feel like you're an insider, you're my people.
This is why Taiwanese politicians go to so many temples. Professor Wang Ye Li at National Taiwan University says, unlike, say, many Christians in the U.S., a Taiwanese temple goer might not care if a candidate has no faith.
In Taiwan, it's just important for politicians to show their respect to the local temple. It's not absolutely necessary that they believe.
Wang says the important part for politicians is just showing up. Some politicians in Taiwan will claim that certain deities actually back their campaigns. The Taiwanese billionaire Terry Guo, founder of Foxconn, which assembles iPhones, has run for president twice, including this year. In 2019, he was surrounded by reporters on the street, asking him, "Sir, why are you running?" For Matsu, he said. Matsu is probably the most beloved goddess in Taiwan. Guo said she came to him in a dream, telling him he should be president. Professor Wang says politicians who lean too hard on their Taoist beliefs can seem insincere.
I can't believe they 100% in their hearts really think that they have the support of a deity. I think that it's an election strategy.
Wang says he doesn't think any politician deep down really thinks they have a deity's backing. They're just trying to get elected. Back at the temple in New Taipei City, Zeng Poyu, now that her prayers are complete, gets to work. She greets everyone she sees. Temple attendants in bright robes, plus casual adherents dressed in street clothes. Zeng says hello to one of the temple chairmen named Liu Jinxiong. The chairman tells me, "Oh, we've had everyone come through here. The Taiwanese president, the vice president too." I ask if Zeng, in coming here, has picked up any votes. But Chairman Liu pushes back on that line of questioning. Every political party coming through here, he says, gets treated warmly. The temple never takes sides. And Zeng Poyu says that's totally fair. She's just here to show her face. This is the Taiwanese version of shaking hands and kissing babies, only she's lighting incense and exalting the local gods. But that prayer earlier, that was sincere, she says. To win this race, she'll take all the help she can get, even from the spirit world.
And how does it make you feel after you pray?
Usually you feel empowered, because you feel like, you know, someone's taking care of you. So when you are running your campaign in this area, you feel protected, you feel taken care of.
And with that, Zeng Poyu says her goodbyes. The night is still young, and if she hurries, she can put in an appearance at another temple across town. For the World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in New Taipei City.
While reporting this story, Patrick also visited a Taoist temple devoted to the rabbit god, who has become revered by LGBTQ people in Taiwan. They come to his shrine for help in finding a partner.
I hope you can bring a boy to me, and he's a smart guy, and he loves reading.
Maybe he likes drink coffee and hope he's adorable guy and a good-looking guy. Yes.
That story is on our website at theworld.org/sacrednation. It's where you can find all of our work for Sacred Nation, a reporting project about religion and nationalism. Fast forward to Easter and Holy Week in Guatemala, when ornate designs from organic materials decorate the streets. Then it all gets trampled by a procession of Jesus carrying a cross.
Triste que pase tan rápido.
It's sad it goes so fast, but it's deeply satisfying. That and more stories about faith ahead on this Christmas Day on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. On this first day of Hanukkah, we turn our attention to a maybe unlikely place, Kolkata, formerly Calcutta, India. In the heyday of the British Empire, Kolkata had a thriving Jewish community. Today, there are only about 20 or so Jews in the entire city, and the synagogues that once held services are shuttered. But one synagogue, built in the 19th century, recently opened its doors for a special occasion. Reporter Sandeep Roy brings us the story from Kolkata.
At 94, Flau Silliman was the oldest living graduate of the Jewish Girls' School of Kolkata. So it wasn't surprising that students of the school came together to sing a hymn at her memorial service at the Magan David Synagogue in Kolkata in November. Except the names of the girls singing this traditional Jewish hymn don't sound very Jewish at all.
Alina, Anika, Shemaisha, Fatima,
Anasha.
Almost all the students at the Jewish girls' school in Kolkata are Muslim. The current estimate is that only around 20 Jews are left in Kolkata, mostly in their 70s or older, says Brian Auckland, the treasurer of the school.
So in any religious seminary, now it's mostly, burials. Okay, there's never, I think for the past 35 or 40 years, there's never been a marriage.
Even a funeral is difficult. Jewish tradition requires a minyan or 10 men to conduct a service. There's no minyan anymore, says Sidney Moses, vice president of the synagogue.
We don't have a rabbi. And the body is washed by the local people who we have engaged to wash the body. The prayers are read in English.
But there are still three beautifully maintained synagogues. The Magan David, where Silliman's memorial was held, a brick-red building with marble floors, chandeliers and stained glass windows, is the largest and possibly the only synagogue with a steeple. Flower Silliman told me several years ago.
The British people who built it decided to put a steeple because they thought it was a house of worship. We said, but synagogues don't have steeples. Why not?
The Jews of Kolkata wrote to the chief rabbi of Baghdad for advice. He said, okay, but...
It should be higher than any other place of worship for a radius of so much and so forth.
The Jews of Kolkata were called Baghdadi Jews. They came to India as traders from all over the Middle East during the 18th and 19th century. At one time, there were about 5,000 Jews living in Kolkata. The three synagogues were bustling.
When we were there, you couldn't even get a seat to sit in. You had to reserve your seat beforehand.
Her daughter Yael didn't share the same enthusiasm as her mother.
I never loved going to the synagogue as a child. I actually found it quite boring. The prayers were in Hebrew. I didn't have my best friends or my school friends there.
In Kolkata, synagogues like Magan David are right next to churches, mosques and Hindu temples. Flower remembered trying to observe Yom Kippur while church bells rang, muezzins called the faithful to prayer in mosques and drums beat in temples.
And I remember telling my mother, God must be getting deaf at so many people trying to get his attention at the same time.
Her mother scolded her.
And she said, don't talk like that. God is everybody's God, you know.
It's a lesson that Kolkata's little Jewish community took to heart. For example, they realized that people who understood their dietary rules best were Muslims. So the people known as Jewish cooks, meaning they cooked Jewish food for Jewish people, they weren't usually Jewish.
They were always Muslims.
In fact, Flower Suleiman had a Muslim cook, and her daughter says the cook was more Jewish than her mom. He would get upset if Flower didn't observe all the traditions.
He used to call my mommy Baba. Baba is not following the law. I'm going to tell her mother.
Now those Jewish cooks are gone, as are the Jews of Kolkata. A wave of emigration starting in the late 1940s took them elsewhere for better opportunities and larger Jewish communities, says Susan Lynn Iyer, who came to the memorial with her mother.
In London, in Israel, America, mainly England and Israel.
But the institutions they built still remain. Schools, synagogues, a Jewish bakery. Aya says she still comes to the synagogue on Jewish holidays with her mother, even though there's no service.
You just pray and go. There's no one here.
But that's not quite true. The synagogues have been left in the care of men like Abdul Khan, who hands out Jewish head coverings for us to wear inside. He says he is the third generation of his family working here. He's not the only one, says Sidney Moses. Generations of Muslim caretakers are the custodians of Kolkata's Jewish heritage.
It's their dedication. Their dedication, they say.
It's still a reminder that sometimes we have more in common with each other than we realize. That's why at her memorial, Flower Suleiman's friend Aparna Guha bade her goodbye with a prayer of a different hue. For the world, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
Spiritual, but not religious. That phrase might be familiar to you. Many Americans describe themselves this way. The same is true in the United Kingdom, one of the most secular societies in the world. Reporter Rebecca Rossman recently met with young Brits to talk about some of the alternative spiritual traditions they're turning toward, like mysticism, tarot, and astrology. Rebecca found out more in the cellar of an esoteric bookshop.
In this dimly lit bookshop basement, tarot card reader Orlando Harrison is preparing a deck of 78 cards set to determine, well, a lot of things.
It'll just examine past, future, present position, ambitions and dreams, and subconscious desires in a sort of cross formation.
Okay, that's a lot.
You know, you said basic, but that sounds like a lot to me.
With that many questions answered in less than an hour, it's easy to see the appeal. Harrison, who has been practicing tarot for 5 decades, calls it another form of counseling.
Unlike, you know, psychotherapy, where you have to embark on a huge long course and, you know, can be a very torturous and tedious process, I mean, tarot is very vivid and very immediate. Go through the pack, and what I'm going to do is ask you to pick what's called a significator.
Call it a form of speed therapy, one that is attracting an increasing number of young people here in the UK. We are in Treadwell's, a bookshop in central London which specializes in the occult. The occult, paganism, Wicca, shamanism, these are all loosely related forms of alternative spirituality.
Everyone's just grappling for the meaning of life, really. They're looking for it in different ways.
That's 31-year-old Coco Kaur, a bookseller at Treadwell's. Kaur says she got into tarot several years ago while working as a receptionist for a psychic reader whose clients included Kim Kardashian. Kaur says her interest in tarot morphed into a wider curiosity for the supernatural and mystical.
I kind of have always thought that there was something going on, so it's just searching for answers to kind of affirm that or go alongside that.
Today, Kaur describes herself as a loose pagan, a belief that the divine is with us in the natural world, as opposed to some far-off place. According to the most recent UK census, 74,000 people identify as pagan today, up from 17,000 just over a decade ago. And the fastest-growing religious practice amongst young people is shamanism, which involves a practitioner interacting with the spirit world through things like trance.
You know, it's really practical.
Linda Woodhead is a professor of religious studies at King's College London. She says belief in alternative spirituality and use of shamanic healers is more pragmatic than you may think.
They will literally bring down your blood pressure, and they will bring you mental calm if you're stressed, and they will, in the case of astrology, it will help guide your day. It will say, look out for this, that and the other. You know, it kind of gives you a framework for living.
Practicality aside, many feel these beliefs still do hold a certain stigma.
First thing we do is we're going to light the incense.
I'm back at Treadwell's with the shop owner, Christina Oakley Harrington, who is performing the shop's weekly purification.
Blessed be the vervain.
A Western esoteric ritual that involves purifying with two kinds of incense, salt water, and sound. Oakley Harrington spent the first 15 years of her professional life in academia, working as a professor of medieval history. In her private life, she was also a practicing pagan, something she hid from her co-workers. Because if they knew...
I would have lost my job.
You would have lost your job?
Yeah. It would have been deemed to bring the university into disrepute. I worked for a Catholic university.
Oakley Harrington says, had this happened today, things might be different, and that growing interest from young people is helping to destigmatize things.
Often when younger people come in, they'll say, I'm drawn to this, I don't quite know where it's going to take me.
There's a big ecological element to these kinds of beliefs. With the ongoing climate crisis being a top concern for many young people, Oakley Harrington says it's no wonder they're turning in this direction.
There's books on exploration of ecology, of the spirituality of the trees, of nature traditions.
But above all, the explanation for what attracts people to alternative spirituality may be pretty simple.
What my religious life gives me as a pagan is the same thing that my best friend who's Catholic, that her religious life gives to her.
Which is a sense of being right in oneself and right with the divine, whatever that may look like. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, London.
One of the largest religious gatherings on earth happens each year in Iraq. Arbayin is a day to remember the death of Imam Hussein back in the 7th century. He was the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Arbayin attracts people of all ages for this pilgrimage. Each year, tens of millions of people participate, including several million who come from outside Iraq. The World's Sara Hassan brought us this report from Arbayin in 2023.
Imam Hussein is an important figure in Islam, and especially revered by Shia Muslims. He's buried in Karbala in Iraq. It's there that I meet Kaniz Fatima Alvi, before she set off to make the walk from Najaf to Karbala. That's about 50 miles apart. Alvi is here with her husband, her mother, and a friend. They've come from Colombia.
I hope first I can do it because this is really different, the heat, the culture.
The heat is a major factor in the summer. Temperatures can reach up to 116 degrees Fahrenheit. So many people choose to do the walk at night. Alvi, who converted to Islam about a decade ago, has been to Iraq once before, but this is her first time doing the walk.
You feel something really different in your heart, in your mind, like all your body, like experience a different energy.
Lisseth Diaz is walking with Elvi and her family. She's also from Colombia and converted to Islam last year. Diaz says she's also looking for a meaningful spiritual experience.
I know that I am learning and I can better understanding. And I feel that being here, I can understand better. I can get close to God.
Both women are dressed in black, like just about everyone else on the walk, the color of mourning. This is a somber event. Arbayin means 40 in Arabic. It marks the 40th day of mourning after Ashura, the day that Prophet Muhammad's grandson Hussein was killed in the year 680. For pilgrims, this walk is all about honoring Hussein's legacy. Most people begin the journey in the city of Najaf, and they make their way to Karbala, where Hussein's shrine is located. But some people start walking in Basra further south, or even from Baghdad, the capital, which is 75 miles north.
The Arbayin walk is not an obligation on Muslims like the pilgrimage to Mecca is.
That's Sayyid Muhammad Bakr Qazwini, referring to the annual Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia. Hazwini is living in Najaf now, but he's also an assistant imam in Dearborn Heights, Michigan.
However, the Prophet's family highly recommended Muslims to visit Imam Hussein in Karbala after his martyrdom. They wanted to preserve his legacy because Imam Hussein represents justice, freedom. He rose to say no to the dictator of his time. He rose to say no to injustice.
It's this story of justice and sacrifice that inspires many people during Arba'in. The walk was even banned during the time of Saddam Hussein because people would use the occasion to challenge his government. More recently, ISIS carried out violent attacks against pilgrims, but since then, the Iraqi government has stepped up security for the annual walk. Charity and service are huge themes throughout the Arba'in Walk. In 2019, UNESCO named the hospitality that happens here as an intangible cultural heritage of humanity. Imamiyah Medics International has been traveling to Iraq for 15 years to give free services to pilgrims and locals. Qasim Jaffrey is one of the group's directors. He's been based in Ireland for more than 2 decades. He says these medical facilities are open to patients 24/7 during Arba'in.
Some of them would be sick from before, and they may have forgotten their medication, or this Arba'in visit may have exacerbated their diseases, and some of them get sick while they're here.
Jaffrey says they treat thousands of patients every year and even offer dental services. Some local Iraqis also open up their homes to visitors. Sheikh Hassan al-Masudi is a tribal leader in Karbala.
Every year I provide services to welcome the pilgrims visiting Imam Hussein. We offer food and drink, showers and bathrooms, and I also put out mattresses for them to sleep on.
All along the pilgrimage route, there are more than 1,000 stations, or mawqibs, where people can stop to rest. Along the walk itself, everything is free of charge. People set up and sponsor stalls for handing out water, meals, tea, and services. One woman is even repairing people's bags that have worn out during the walk. There are even people offering free foot massages. Zain Fatima Burani is here with a group of women from India.
Some people don't wear any shoes and they are so much in pain. So we feel like they are getting some of the comforts and relief.
This year, the Iraqi government offered free visas for 4 new countries, Pakistan, Lebanon, Yemen, and Afghanistan, in addition to Iran. The overwhelming majority of people who participate in the Arba'in Walk are Shia Muslims, but Sunnis participate too, and so do Christians and Hindus. Salil Abbas, who was part of a group that came from the UK, says he spoke with a group of Christians about their experience.
So I asked them, I said, so what have you found in this journey, in this walk? And they said, we've never seen people give things away the way that the lovers of this imam and this leader of yours are giving away. We have never seen selflessness of this kind anywhere. And it is an inspiration to see this.
An inspiration that people try to take back home with them after the Arba'in walk to continue serving others. For The World, I'm Sarah Hassan in Karbala, Iraq.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. On this Christmas Day, we're going to look ahead to the next big Christian holiday, Easter. In Latin America, Holy Week is called Semana Santa. It's a big deal, especially in Guatemala, where the celebrations have been declared a UNESCO World Heritage event. Reporter Michael Fox brought us this postcard from Antigua, Guatemala.
Francisco Orellana is not the image of the person you'd expect to find actively participating in Catholic Holy Week celebrations. He's 26, flowered shirt, pierced ear, a sliver of a beard. But right now, he's guiding a group of friends in creating a huge ornate design on the street in front of his house to honor Jesus. He's been doing this his whole life. I learned to do this from my great-grandparents and my grandparents, he says. They get you involved from a young age. And then when they get too old, your parents continue the tradition, and then you, he says. He's making an alfombra, or carpet, for the church procession to Passover. He crouches down. He and his friends pull colored wood chippings out of bags and layer them onto the cobblestone streets. It's a vibrant design of purple, orange, yellow, and green shapes that almost looks like it would be at home in a modern art museum. Instead, it's going to be trampled.
Nosotros empezamos hoy hace como una hora. Nuestro diseño de hoy, pues, es un poco.
We started about an hour ago, he says. This design is a little more basic because we're making another one in the afternoon. The neighbors up the street are making a carpet out of pine needles and flowers.
Cada vez es diferente diseño, diferente material, diferente alfombra.
Each carpet is different, he says. Each design and material is unique. But the idea is to make an offering to Jesus for everything he's given us, he says. And then comes the procession. Hundreds of people are dressed in purple robes. They carry a huge wooden float depicting Jesus shouldering the cross, and they wind through the city streets for hours, walking across the freshly made carpets. After the procession passes, I ask Oriana how it feels to see his hard work destroyed.
Triste que pase tan rápido.
It's kind of sad that it goes by so fast for all the time that you invest in it, he says. But there's also a deep satisfaction. We're celebrating one more year. We made it. It's really beautiful, he says. That is how many in the streets feel. Hundreds of thousands are here for the celebrations. And this year, Oriana tells me, people are more passionate than ever. For The World, I'm Michael Fox. In Antigua, Guatemala.
If you walk the streets of Bangkok or other cities in Thailand, you might notice bottles of red Fanta everywhere. Yep, Fanta, the soda. But they're not for people. From Bangkok, The World's Patrick Nguyen picks up the story at his local 7-Eleven.
I'm here to buy a special elixir, strawberry Fanta. Ask any Thai person and they'll tell you, this bright red soda is the favored drink of friendly ghosts. See, in Thai culture, every home, from mansions to shacks, they're all inhabited by spirits. But you've got to be nice to them, because if you neglect the good spirits, they'll leave your home defenseless against the evil ones. One way to keep them happy? Give them red Fanta. Apparently, they love it. I tell the cashier I'm making a spirit offering. And then I ask for some advice. Do ghosts need straws?
Don't eat away, don't say lot, my cat.
Yes, she says, and puts a few straws in the bag. In Thailand, every street has a spirit house, a designated place for angels to congregate. I head over to my local spirit house and crack open a few sodas. I've given Fanta to the neighborhood spirits, so they should be satisfied for now, and they'll hang out here all day and keep the evil forces away from my home. Down the street, I find a small clothing store with a solitary bottle of red Fanta out front. I slip off my shoes and step inside to meet the owner, named Wachari. I ask her, does this stuff really help fulfill your wishes? It works, she says. If business is slow, I'll put out the Fanta, pray for customers, and they'll just walk in. She says Fanta actually attracts a special kind of ghost, the Guman Tong. It's like a magic, invisible baby. And naturally, kids love sugary soda. Fanta sells like crazy in Thailand. This is its fourth largest market in the world, even bigger than China or the U.S. Obviously, Fanta's supernatural vibe is helping to push sales. But when I ask people on the street, why red Fanta? I get scattered answers. Mostly, people say it's just tradition. I need to talk to someone with a deeper footing in the spirit world. So I arranged to meet a man named Wachadapon, nickname Jack. He's the host of Ghost Radio. It's a call-in show entirely devoted to the occult.
The Ghost Radio, Ghost Siri.
Jack says, honestly, no one really knows what angels like to eat or drink. We just give them stuff we think they might like. Thai society just organically agreed on red Fanta, he says. And now it's the go-to offering. Yes, but why red? Surely, I say, it must link back to blood sacrifice. This is a popular theory online. But Jack hates this idea. No, no, he says. Angels are vegetarian. They only eat fruit and dessert. You'd never give bloody meat to an angel. Do that, and angels will move out. Demons will move in. Suddenly, your family will start fighting. Your stuff will go missing. You'll get hurt or sick. Now, I did invite Coca-Cola, the makers of Fanta, to comment for this story. They declined, saying they appreciate Thailand's loyalty, but Fanta's occult powers are, quote, not something we promote. Fair enough, says Jack. Thai people wouldn't like their traditions polluted by marketing, he says. But Coca-Cola can't do anything to separate Fanta from ghosts. In the Thai mind, he says, that link runs deep. In fact, you might get teased if you order a strawberry Fanta in front of your Thai friends, he says. You know what they'll say, he says? Hey, who do you think you are? A ghost baby? For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok, Thailand.
Bottles of red Fanta close out our holiday broadcast today. Our reporting on religion is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Join us right back here tomorrow for all the day's global news.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.